The Nowhere Dispatch podcast explores the darkest reaches of small towns, wrong turns down dirt roads, and those mysterious things that you can never quite explain. Tune in, listeners, as I, Lucas, your host, tell you about the eerie and creepy things I've found out here in East Texas. From true crime and cold cases to tales of the paranormal, cryptids, and local legends, you'll find something that speaks to the creepy side of your mind. Find the Nowhere Dispatch at nowhere-dispatch.com and listen in on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. We'll be waiting for you to join us on our journey through nowhere.
Hey there, this is Erica Kelly, and you're listening to Southern Fried True Crime. I wanted to tell you about a new podcast called Swindled. The host, a concerned citizen, delves into famous and obscure cases about white-collar and corporate crime. These aren't stories you generally hear in the true crime genre, but they are absolutely fascinating. Check it out on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that may not be suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. About 20 years ago, Irish playwright Martin McDonagh took a bus ride across America. While riding through the southern states, he caught a fleeting glimpse at three billboards. If you ask him, he won't pinpoint Vidor, Texas as the location, but he does say it's possible, he just doesn't remember. What he does remember is the feeling the signs invoked. And the memory never left him. He eventually wrote a screenplay inspired by what he saw called Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That movie, which he also directed, just racked up 6 Golden Globes and is on track to be an Academy Award darling as well. I saw it last Saturday, and it is powerful. There are some eerie parallels to today's episode, but I won't spoil the movie for you. Because McDonagh may not remember specifically which southern town, but he certainly captured the corruption, ambivalence, and incompetence inherent in so many small-town police forces. He also perfectly captured the rage and grief of the parent of a murder victim. Welcome to Episode 10, Three Billboards Outside Vidor, Texas, The Murder of Kathy Page. Vidor police botched up the case, waiting for confession. This could happen to you. That's what was hand-painted on three successive billboards along I-10 near Rose City, Texas, in the early 90s. The signs were put up by James Fulton on his own property. His daughter, Lucille Catherine Page, was found in her car around 4:20 a.m. on May 14, 1991, in nearby Vidor, Texas, which is just a few miles west of the Louisiana border. Her car was nose down in a ditch, just 100 yards from her house on Bolivar Street. She was found by a newspaper carrier. Vidor Detective Ray Mosley was on the scene by 5 a.m. He later said the cops were immediately suspicious. Kathy Page's feet were not even near the pedals. They were pushed back against her seat. She was also not thrown forward, even though she wasn't wearing a seatbelt. Her head was on the headrest and turned to the side. He said the car had minimal damage, and there was no evidence that the brakes had even been applied. More like the car had been slow-rolled into the ditch. An autopsy would show that she'd been beaten and strangled. From the bruising on her neck, it appeared she was strangled by someone using their left hand, and she had fractured bones around her larynx. She had a black eye, and her nose was broken. There was blood on her body and in her underwear, but not on her clothes. And she'd had sex shortly before her death. Whether or not this could have been rape was not addressed, but the report did find that the semen found belonged to a man who'd had a vasectomy. Her jewelry and socks were missing, and she had no makeup on. Her sister said that it was her nightly habit to take off all her jewelry and makeup and put her hair up before showering and going to bed. Even without knowing her routine, the police could tell she had obviously been redressed and posed in the car. There was also a blade of grass on the back of her jeans, suggesting that she'd been dragged. Later, when her clothes were more closely inspected, transfer blood was found on the inside, again confirming that she had been redressed. After helping put Kathy's body into an ambulance, Detective Mosley went straight to Kathy's house. Her estranged husband, Stephen Allen Page, answered the door in boxer shorts. Before Mosley or the other officer, Lieutenant Carter, even mentioned her name, Steve blurted out, "Kathy's not here," and then asked them if this was about her. Both cops said he then stepped out the door, glanced at the carport, and then looked directly towards where Kathy's car had been found. Lieutenant Carter told him that his wife had been found dead, and Steve immediately became dramatically emotional, throwing himself on the couch and crying loudly. But Detective Mosley said, when he shined the flashlight on him, he saw no tears. It should be noted here that both officers were longtime acquaintances of Steve Page. It should also be noted that they both gave detailed accounts of Steve's odd behavior in their reports, in interviews with the media, and later at the civil trial. You can put that in your back pocket for later. And so began a long, frustrating, and fruitless investigation into Kathy Page's murder. The only trial conducted was the civil trial for wrongful death, 9 years later. But let me back up a bit and give you more history on Vidor, Texas, and the marriage of Kathy and Steve Page. Vidor is located in western Orange County, Texas, lying at the intersection of Interstate 10 and Farm-to-Market Road 105, 6 miles east of Beaumont, Texas. The small town is basically a bedroom community for the crude oil refinery complexes in Beaumont and Port Arthur. The population hovers around 13,000 and is about 98% white, and only 1% African American. This isn't a surprising statistic, as Vidor has a long, sordid history of racism and open association with the Ku Klux Klan. It was not integrated until 1993, when a solitary retired black man moved into a federal housing project, causing reactions ranging from run-of-the-mill racists who proclaimed they didn't mind him moving in but didn't plan on interacting with him, to the outraged and proud racists promising to meet him with a baseball bat. Again, this was 1993. Police officers had to be stationed around his apartment 24 hours a day until things calmed down. Mr. John Dequeer, the first black Vidor resident since the 1920s, was quoted as saying, "I don't understand why this is such a big deal. I'm just renting an apartment." I think Mr. Dequeer was attempting to downplay the significance of his move to Vidor, probably in hopes of avoiding confrontation with his new racist neighbors. After all, the racism rampant in Vidor was sure as hell no secret. For a town that would famously always be associated with murder billboards, as Kathy Page's daughter calls them, in the 1960s, they were famous for another billboard with a racial epithet right at the entrance to the town. It read, "Don't let the sun set on you, Vidor." Vidor remained a hotbed of Klan activity into the late 70s. Finally, in 1982, the tide did turn a bit when the town canceled the Christmas parade after an outside Klan group entered a float. But it took almost 10 more years for a black person to be willing to move in. After Mr. Dequeer moved in and a few other black families followed, the Klan marched on Vidor once again. A reporter named Keith Oppenheim traveled to Vidor in 2006 to cover its history of racism, and he was dismayed by the blatant and casual racism he still found there. He found that Vidor officials acknowledged the ever-present racism, but insisted the town had changed in the last 30 years. Mayor Joe Hopkins said, "The vast majority of our citizens are not racist. We'd welcome anybody here who is a good, solid citizen." But on down the road, at the local cafe, a good, solid citizen named Peggy Frouge said, "I don't mind being friends with them, talking and stuff like that, but as far as mingling and eating with them, that's where I draw the line." Once again, this was 2006, only 12 years ago, not in the middle of Jim Crow era South. Not to be outdone by the town racists, Vidor cops have a terrible reputation. They are often accused of racial profiling and bias, but they are also criticized for their investigative shortcomings, nepotism, laziness, and just the standard good old boy mentality. Indeed, they were lambasted heavily over the Page investigation that was riddled with ridiculous errors and outright incompetence, starting with forgetting to put film in the camera before photographing the scene of Kathy's car. Kathy and Steve were married on November 18, 1978, in Jefferson, Texas. She was 21 and he was 22 years old. But he'd already had a short marriage to a woman named Anita Duhon. They were divorced on August 8th, just 3 months before Steve married Kathy. And then Kathy gave birth to their daughter Erin on May 29th, 1979. So she was pregnant with Erin when they married, and their affair is likely what broke up Steve's first marriage. I'd also like you to keep that one in your back pocket. But by most accounts, Steve's second marriage to Kathy was a happy one for a long time. Daughter Monica was born 5 years after Erin on December 9, 1983. They were a close-knit family, living in a small town, and they also stayed close to their own extended families. Very close. But by early May of 1991, things had changed. Kathy had taken a job waiting tables at a restaurant called Hofbräu in Beaumont, and had made friends that she was socializing with. Her daughter Erin said many years later that she was taking courses at a local college. She was already taking steps away from Steve and their almost 13-year marriage. In May, the week before her death, she had asked for a separation, and Steve had moved his things to an apartment across the freeway from their house. On Mother's Day, the whole family went to the beach together, and then Steve made fried shrimp. Kathy and Steve wanted to have a good day all together as a family before the separation for the girls' sake. That night, he spent his first night alone in the apartment. That was Sunday, May 12th. The next day, Steve came back to the house that morning and helped the girls get ready before taking them to school. He evidently was back at the house before noon. According to Steve, he and Kathy washed her car together and then went separately to the ballpark for the girls' softball games. They were seen at the ballpark, and then Kathy brought Monica home when her game ended, while Steve stayed and waited for Erin's game to end. He brought Erin home afterwards and claims he left the house around 10:30, only to be called back by Kathy. She was going out with friends and wanted him to babysit. This version of the story is supported by friends and Kathy's sisters, who said she called asking for a babysitter and none of them could help her out. Her friend, Charlotte Swearingen Morgan, said that Kathy called her around 9:30 or 10 and asked her, not to babysit, but to cover for her with Steve. You see, Kathy had a boyfriend in Beaumont and was going to meet him at a hotel. This wasn't the first time she'd asked her friend to cover for her either. Specifically, she asked Charlotte not to pick up her phone, which Charlotte did anyway at 2:30 a.m., only to have the caller hang up. She said this wasn't odd and that she usually thought the mystery caller was Steve Page. This night was no different, and after the caller hung up on her, she went back to sleep. She was awoken between 5:30 and 6 a.m. when Steve Page called again. This time he asked if she knew where Kathy was. She told him no, but that they had gone out together earlier, and Kathy left to go home around 2 a.m. After she hung up, she called the hotel room where Kathy and her boyfriend met, but no one answered. The timing of this call is interesting. Charlotte cannot give a definite time, and the Vidor police reportedly never checked the phone records, but she was sure it was between 5:30 and 6 a.m. Kathy was found at 4:20 a.m. Cops with lights and probably sirens would have surrounded the car. He doesn't say what specific time that he knocked on the door and spoke to Steve, but he did say he was with him for 15 or 20 minutes. Let's say he only spent 15 minutes at Kathy's car, and that is a slim window of time considering he waited to make sure her body was loaded in the ambulance. But let's say 15, and then another 15 minutes talking to Steve. That would be about 5:30-ish, right? And then Charlotte testifies that Steve called and asked where Kathy was between 5:30 and 6 a.m. It's pretty obvious that by then, even if he wasn't the murderer, he knew where she was. And what's more, Mosley told him that Kathy did not die in the car accident and that the scene was definitely staged. And here, we have the first really stupid investigative error. Well, aside from the camera film, obviously. I get why the detective told Steve all of this. We all know that when it comes to a murder, the first suspect is the husband or significant other. If they already knew she didn't die in a car accident, why ask the question then instead of under formal questioning? Was he hoping for an excited utterance? The legal definition of an excited utterance is a statement that concerns a startling event made by the declarant when the declarant is still under stress from the startling event. An excited utterance is admissible under an exception to the hearsay rule. Lieutenant Carter then told Steve Page that Kathy had been strangled. So it does seem that the men were looking for a reaction, if you give them enough credit to understand the law. Okay, if so, why not take him in for questioning right then? You could say probable cause, and you'd be right. But at the very least, since they knew Kathy was murdered, why weren't Steve and the children immediately removed from the home? The Page home automatically should have been treated as a crime scene, because at this point that early May morning, the cops did not know yet where Kathy had been that evening, much less where she had been killed. What they did know was that the accident was staged. Any investigator would have immediately searched the home of the murder victim, even if it was definitively not the crime scene. Steve also did not ask to see Kathy, or even try to walk over to the scene at the car. At this point, according to his own testimony, Detective Mosley considered Steve's behavior suspicious. Alarm bells should have been screaming in his head. But did he secure the home while waiting for a search warrant? No. He said they'd be in touch and left Steve alone in the home with his sleeping daughters. The police returned shortly after 7 a.m., asking for Steve's permission to perform an autopsy. Steve said no, that he did not want her cut open. Kathy's father, James, known as Jimmy, consented to the autopsy. At this point, they still did not search the home. I would think that by 7 a.m., when they returned to ask for the autopsy, they could have had a judge woken up and a search warrant signed. Everything the police did that morning seemed suspicious to many people, particularly Jimmy Fulton. But to me, these could also be just careless or lazy mistakes, perhaps made by small-town cops who weren't experienced investigating murders. To make matters worse, as the case drug on and they were going nowhere, they refused all outside help. From the state police to the Texas Rangers and even the FBI, all offers were turned down. At this time, I would like to take a small break to hear a word from our sponsors. Now, let me back up again and go back to the timeline. At the civil trial, every person that came in and out of the Page residence that morning testified. A huge point of contention was whether or not Steve was doing laundry. Everyone on Kathy's side of the family said Steve was already running the washing machine when they arrived. Everyone on Steve's side of the family claimed that they heard no washing machine, nor did they see Steve doing laundry. Okay, who should we believe? Maybe a minister? Reverend R.J. Bienvenu testified that it was still dark when he went into the Page's kitchen to use the phone. So, it still would have been around 6:30 a.m. before the sun would have risen. He could hear the clothes washer on the spin cycle. Considering that the people arguing this point fell directly on either side, I'll take a tiebreaker from the minister. The Fultons, Kathy's parents, were the first ones there, arriving about 10 minutes after 6 a.m. Already, we have a really tight timeline going here. This is less than an hour from when detectives were on the scene at the car, and 2 hours since the car was discovered. Charlotte Morgan already said that Steve called her between 5:30 and 6 a.m., presumably right after the cops had left, because Steve did not make any calls in their presence, and we know they were already knocking on that door by 5:30, 5:45 at the latest. Especially since they were already gone by the time the Fultons showed up. Steve would later say that he called Charlotte at 3:30 a.m., and then changed his story to 4:30. It's pretty obvious that he was aware the call could be construed as being made after the police had been to his house, and therefore he was already forming a cover story when he called Charlotte, asking where Kathy was. Dorothy Fulton, Kathy's mother, testified that shortly before 6 a.m., Steve Page called her with news that something terrible had happened to her daughter. This further supports Charlotte's testimony of when Steve called her. He obviously picked up the phone and started making calls as soon as the police left. When Dorothy and her husband arrived after 6 a.m., she said Steve was walking around the living room, wiping his hands with a wet bath cloth. By then, Steve was wearing red shorts, a white t-shirt, and was barefoot. She also said he had a scratch on his nose. This scratch was denied by Steve, his family, and the police. Okay, I really don't believe Dorothy Fulton was making this up. Of course, I think it's obvious by now you know that I believe Steve murdered his wife, but that's beside the point. The point is, there are no photographs of Steve to prove whether or not he had scratches on his face or anywhere else on his body. Again, Steve would have been the prime suspect immediately. Even if he didn't have scratches, documenting his appearance would have been checking something off of a list. A list even small-town cops should have been well aware of. But it's patently obvious that the Vidor police were not checking any lists, were not doing anything by the book. At best, they could be called sloppy, and at worst, they were protecting Steve Page and concealing evidence. Dorothy was one of the first to testify that Steve was doing laundry early that morning, before Aaron and Monica Page woke up. She said she did not see what he was laundering, but that there were clothes on hangers laid out on the living room floor, although there was room for them to hang up on the indoor line where Kathy normally dried her clothes. This is pretty specific, and again, rings true. She also said that Steve told her that Kathy had asked him to come over and watch the girls while she went to go have a drink with some girlfriends. Steve said that Kathy had been out drinking with friends the night before, and that she'd driven off into the ditch and possibly broken her neck. He would also hint to others that it was a possible suicide. Remember, he already knew that Kathy had been strangled to death, and yet he was running his mouth, giving different stories to different people. At some point that awful morning, according to Dorothy Fulton, Steve randomly told her that he hoped they never found out who killed Kathy. According to Steve, he made this comment because a friend had told him Kathy had been with a man in a hotel, and because family members were saying that she'd used cocaine. At the civil trial, Steve admitted that his statement about Kathy having used cocaine was untrue. Kathy had a prescription for Valium, but was not known to use any illegal drugs. Steve explained that he was hearing rumors of drug use and made the mistake of just repeating those rumors. But he couldn't recall who told him Kathy had been using drugs. Dorothy also said he mentioned that he did not want the police coming in his house because they may find blood on the carpet in the lounge where Kathy had shaved her leg. Jimmy Fulton also testified to this, saying he heard Steve say he didn't want the police in his house because they may find some blood or something in the living room area where she had been shaving her legs. Ladies, do you often shave your legs in the living room? Jimmy Fulton also testified that he tried to convince Steve to let the police in, but Steve said he knew the police department had planted stuff on some of his friends before. So, now we know the police did at least ask to come in and were denied. Fine, yes, they needed a warrant. But they were within their rights to station an officer at the house to make sure the home was not disturbed or altered in any way. I think it's also interesting that Steve made this comment about planted evidence because, as we know, the Fultons and many others in Vidor believed the police covered up Steve's guilt, that all these bumbling mistakes were actually deliberate. A whole day went by before Steve went in for questioning. Detective Mosley interviewed Steve Page at the police station on Tuesday afternoon. Steve told the detective that he didn't want them in his house because they might find something that would incriminate him. It was during this interview that Steve Page dropped the bomb that he and Kathy had consensual sex the night she was murdered. He later testified that he left the house before 10:30, but Kathy called him and asked him to come back and watch the kids, so he came back. Supposedly, when Steve arrived at the house, Kathy was wrapped in a towel. He claims he approached her for sex and that they had sex on the carpet in the living room area. This would be the same area he noted to Kathy's mother and sister where she had cut herself shaving. So, coincidentally, the exact spot where they had sex is where she cut herself shaving. Of course, had the police searched, Steve Page was clearly expecting them to find evidence of blood. But they still didn't search the house or even attempt to get a warrant. Detective Mosley said at this point in the questioning, there was an examination of Steve's face and hands, and it revealed no marks. He said this years later at the civil trial, but again, without photographs, where's the proof? I have so many issues with Detective Ray Mosley. The man is a walking contradiction. On the one hand, in media interviews and at the civil trial, he does not paint Steve Page as an innocent man. In fact, he admits suspicion. He just insists that they had no evidence. You had no evidence because you didn't search for any. By Wednesday, Sherry Valentine, Kathy's sister, came to visit her nieces and Steve. When Steve opened the door, she noticed and inquired about a very strong smell. Steve told her that he had spilled some grease and was cleaning the carpet. There were small, oscillating fans set around in the kitchen that Steve said were there to dry out the carpet. Keep in mind, this was Wednesday. Two store clerks would later testify that on that same Wednesday, Steve and two members of his family, presumably his sisters, came and rented a carpet cleaner. Wednesday was also the day that Steve was served with a subpoena for Aaron and Monica to testify before a grand jury the following day, Thursday, only a day before their mother's funeral. On Thursday, during visitation at the funeral home, Kathy's family and friends testified to more odd behavior from Steve, who at times seemed he might faint, who cried without tears, and who kept referring to Kathy Page's body as it. Yes, this is testimony from a grieving and bitter family, but I'm inclined to believe them. At her funeral that Friday, Steve appeared distraught, but again, according to the family, there were no tears. Of course, his family says that he did cry. Much like the washing machine, whether or not Steve Page cried actual tears was a much belabored point at the civil trial. The next day was Saturday, and Dorothy Fulton arrived to see her grandchildren. She said that Steve was burning something in the backyard. Jimmy Fulton testified when he arrived on Sunday, Steve's mother, sister, and sisters-in-law were all working on cleaning the carpet. Steve's mother told him that they had spilled grease on the carpet. Jimmy testified that he didn't believe them, because the path to the side door was covered with linoleum, and they were only working on one spot, not a trail of grease. By that time, the Fultons knew from the autopsy that Kathy had lost some blood. This was the moment when Jimmy realized that Steve had killed his daughter. I cannot imagine what it must have been like to be standing there looking at your daughter's murderer. The audacity of Steve Page and his family openly cleaning the crime scene and destroying evidence must have been so galling to Jimmy Fulton. As we know, this spurned a bitterness that continues to this day. 9 years later, at the civil trial, the Page daughters, Aaron and Monica, were called to testify. Remember, Aaron was 12 and Monica 7 at the time of their mother's murder. So now they would be 19 and 16, and already they seemed to be pitted against each other. Aaron testified that she personally witnessed the grease being spilled when the jar popped out of Steve's hands and the top popped off, but she did not testify as to the date it occurred. Monica testified that no grease was spilled, nor was the carpet ever shampooed. Marjorie, one of Steve's sisters, testified that the grease was spilled after the funeral. She claims she saw it happen. Marjorie also testified that Steve already had a carpet shampooer and denied having rented one. Steve's other sister, Donna, also claimed to have been an eyewitness to the spill. Much like the washing machine testimony, there were two sides claiming different stories, and 9 years later, two teenagers, who probably would not have remembered anyway, had been cajoled into taking sides. And by the way, the police never did get a search warrant until years later when another family was living in the house. The new owners claimed it was the exact same carpet, and the police performed a luminol test, but it was inconclusive. Well, of course it was. After Steve's first cleanup, the all-hands-on-deck shampooing of the carpet, and the passing of so many years, do you really think they would have found blood? I think we all know that there was no grease spilled. It's obvious to me that Steve had already attempted some sort of cleanup by Wednesday, when Sherry, Kathy's sister, came by and noted a strong smell in the damp carpet with fans all around in an attempt to dry it faster. The smell was probably some sort of cleaning agent. However, by Saturday, Steve started floating the spilled grease story. I think that's because at this point, the autopsy results were in. He'd already admitted to having sex with Kathy. He claimed that it was before she left for the evening. As she was getting ready and came out of the shower, he approached her for sex. I don't think he would have admitted to all of this, except the coroner's report stated that the semen found inside of Kathy was from a man who had had a vasectomy. Kathy's boyfriend, who, by the way, was not named in the civil trial nor anywhere else in the media, was tested and had not had a vasectomy. But Steve Page had had one just months before the murder. The boyfriend also submitted to formal questioning and volunteered to take a polygraph test, which Vidor police say he passed. Steve Page refused to take a polygraph. Here is what I think happened. Steve stayed up that night, waiting for his wife to return. He started getting impatient around 2:30 a.m. and called her friend Charlotte, but decided to hang up. Kathy got home around 3 a.m. and showered as she usually did before bed. This is when Steve approached her. One detail that has always rang true to me is Steve saying he saw Kathy wrapped in a bath towel. Every good lie has a little bit of truth to it. Steve saw his estranged wife come out of the bathroom, wrapped in a towel, perhaps smiling to herself or yawning, but otherwise ignoring her husband. They got into a fight. I think Steve already knew about the affair. He had already proven himself suspicious and jealous by calling Kathy's friends when she was out for the night. He knew. And this night, the second official night after their separation, he became enraged. I think he beat his wife, raped her, and strangled her to death. Then he quickly thought of a plan. He redressed her in the clothes she went out in, forgetting to put her jewelry back on, and oblivious to the fact that people may notice she wasn't wearing any makeup. He put her in the car and drove it just 100 yards from their home. He propped her up in the driver's seat, forgetting to buckle the seatbelt or even to put her feet near the pedals, and then slow rolled the car into the ditch. He also did not think to lean her body forwards, as it obviously would have fallen had she actually gone downward into a ditch. Then he went back to the house and started cleaning up, probably thinking he had time. But then the news carrier found her car, called the police, and everything started moving really fast. He spoke with police, but only briefly. He knew then that he had to start making the calls, so first he called Charlotte in a lame attempt to plant in her mind that he was checking on Kathy before she was found. When Kathy's parents got there, he was still washing clothes, probably the towel Kathy was wearing, his own clothing, since he answered the door in boxers, and anything used to clean up the scene. By the next day, he was already disparaging Kathy to her family, claiming that she was using cocaine. He was also swearing up and down to the family that he didn't know she had a boyfriend. Later, at the civil trial, he would insist he didn't know about this boyfriend until he went in for formal questioning the next day. But that is contrary to what her family testified to, and is also not the picture painted by Kathy's friends, who saw him as a jealous and controlling husband. Kathy's sister Sherry agreed and also testified that he had been physically abusive to Kathy in the past. She also insists that her sister would not have had consensual sex with Steve. Before their separation, he had already been sleeping on the couch for a while, and she definitely would not have been intimate with Steve right before going to see her boyfriend. Sherry also believes that Steve found out where Kathy was that night. She was also interviewed for Unsolved Mysteries and said that Steve's sister told her that he found two telephone numbers on a notepad. He called one and Charlotte answered, and then he hung up. He called the other and got the hotel room. And then he waited for his wife to get home. This is only Sherry's story. I cannot find anything about the two phone numbers or the calls substantiated anywhere else. But of course, like I said, the police didn't bother with phone records, and frankly, Sherry Valentine comes off as very credible in this interview. If all of this didn't already make Steve Page look guilty as hell, he would do something incredibly stupid that seals the deal on his guilt for just about anyone familiar with this case. And to me, it was probably the breaking point for Jimmy Fulton and the rest of her family. Steve was caught on camera desecrating Kathy's grave. Her family kept finding the flowers knocked over or destroyed, so they set up a camera, which caught Steve Page angrily kicking the flowers. He tried to claim later that this was out of frustration towards her family, but what kind of sick piece of shit desecrates his wife's grave if he didn't kill her, despite how he feels about her family? And if you really want to feel disgusted about Steve Page, check out his interview with Unsolved Mysteries. He's that kind of weirdo that speaks about himself in the third person. He also is still obviously bitter at his dead wife. He feels that her affair is what got her killed. He didn't elaborate who the affair was with on camera, but if you snoop around long enough online, the rumor he spread was that Kathy's boyfriend was a prominent married man in Beaumont. He said, quote, "I am being blamed for her actions. She was out seeing another guy, so therefore it could only have been me, because according to the police, I somehow found out and became enraged and committed murder." He says this with much sarcasm and coldness and is infuriatingly playing the victim. And let's not forget that the Page marriage started as an affair. He never held any moral high ground over Kathy Page. Then he proceeds to give his own ridiculous theory. Quote, "There was a name of a certain person in Beaumont that was bandied about as the person who may have been involved. It's a very prominent family. An Italian family, even. To let you know, they're considered part of the Beaumont Mafia." Just to let you know, the Beaumont Mafia isn't a thing. Google doesn't even bring up this silly interview to connect with that phrase. But Steve Page swears he's received all kinds of threatening calls over the years from the so-called Beaumont Mafia, telling him that he'll wind up like his wife. It's laughable. What is not laughable is what happened to his daughters. He moved Aaron and Monica to Tennessee almost 3 years after Kathy's murder. By then, the girls were disillusioned with their mother's family. Aaron wrote a blog up until a couple of years ago at texasbillboard.blogspot.com where she speaks of grief and blame. One sentence stuck out to me. "After losing one parent, no child wants to hear anything negative about their other parent." Of course not. But I think it's understandable on the part of the Fultons to try and make the girls understand what their father had done. There probably isn't a child psychologist who would agree with this, but I imagine anyone in a similar situation may have done the same thing. The girls also found out that the Fultons wanted custody of them, and they were frightened. According to Aaron, the Fultons persisted in badmouthing their father and obsessing over her mother's death. I think it is unsurprising and reasonable that she could not process their rage. Erin credits her father's family for actually taking care of her and her sister. She said that once they left Texas, Steve left her and Monica with his sister and took up with a married woman. Erin, in the 10th grade by then, collected her sister and their belongings and showed up on his doorstep. She wanted to force him to take responsibility for her and her sister, but he didn't. Just a couple of months later, she and Monica were living with his parents and never moved back in with their father. Aaron claims that though there were many other reasons, this is essentially what ended the relationship with her father. She does not speak to him or the Fultons to this day. Sadly, Monica died March of 2011 from a drug overdose. I have seen it called suicide in a couple of reports, but Aaron simply says her sister died. She gives no detail. But after what these girls had been through, I'm not sure we need much of an explanation. Erin struggled with her anger at her father, and even more so at her grandparents and her mother's sisters. She hated the billboards, and wrote new blog posts when a different one would pop up. She said, quote, "To me, this billboard is not about my mother. It is about two stubborn, selfish men with too much guilt to carry." But she never says she believes her father is guilty, and even hints to some of the unsavory rumors that her father originally spread. It aligns with how she seemed to tell his side of the story at the civil trial, while her sister did not. And this is probably really why Monica died. Whether it was an accident or suicide, she turned to drugs to deal with the pain and conflict her father and her mother's family put her through. I think Monica did believe her father killed her mother. Erin doesn't explicitly say that either, but it is a feeling I get when reading her blog. Erin is unsure of herself and wavers in her writing. She is clearly angry when a new billboard goes up, posting pictures of the latest billboard along with her writing. Reading her blog is heart-wrenching. It is a raw and unflinching look at the pain she was in and the realities of grief. She hasn't written anything since July of 2014, when the last billboard went up. She is clearly trying to move on with her life and is now a mother of two sons. And what of the billboards? There is one standing to this day. Over the years, they have changed. They started with the three billboards I mentioned in the beginning, reading, "Vidor police botched up the case, waiting for confession, this could happen to you." A later billboard read, "I believe my daughter was being raped while she was strangled in 1991. The Vidor police would not accept outside help and the case has never been solved. I believe the police department did not want to solve this case. Will you be the next unsolved murder?" After the Fultons won the civil trial, they were awarded $200,000, and Jimmy Fulton began naming Steve Page directly on the billboards and also outright accusing the police of a cover-up. The current sign reads, "Steve Page brutally murdered his wife in 1991. Vidor PD does not want to solve this case. I believe they took a bribe. The Attorney General should investigate." In 2012, Vidor Police Chief Dave Shows, who was one of the patrol officers who responded to the crime scene in 1991, said he was sympathetic to Jimmy Fulton and wasn't offended by the billboards. He did have one bit of criticism, though. He said, "You put up a billboard that 70,000 people a day see, and you don't have the intestinal fortitude to say who took the bribe?" This is not a bad point. Whether or not the Fultons actually believe the police were bribed is up for debate. What isn't up for debate is the fact that these billboards still say a lot about the police and Vidor, Texas in general. It's a small town that is still segregated and still suffering from racism and inadequate leadership. Almost 50 years after the original racist billboard welcomed visitors at the entrance, travelers on the I-10 get a daily reminder that the Vidor police force is incompetent, if not outright corrupt. You may be asking yourself why the hell the Vidor police would take a bribe from Steve Page, and even if Steve Page had the means to pay one. I wondered that as well. I thought these billboards were the rage and grief of a parent who was denied justice. I still believe that. But I feel like I have to point out the other rumor that does lend some credence to Jimmy Fulton's claims. The rumor is that the married man whom Kathy was seeing was a prominent citizen in Beaumont, and to protect his identity as Kathy's lover, not as her murderer, the Vidor police did not vigorously pursue this case. Personally, I don't believe Steve Page has or had any real friends in the Vidor Police Department. There are whispers that his family had friends, but other than the civil trial transcript, which characterized them as acquaintances, I can find no real proof outside of the Fulton's claims and, of course, the ever-reliable online comments. And unfortunately, a few different grand juries over the years have failed to indict Steve Page. If a grand jury won't indict, it's up to the DA to decide whether they are willing to risk double jeopardy. Most won't risk it because there is no statute of limitations on murder. They would rather wait and build a stronger case. I understand that. I also understand that when a case is left for years, public interest wanes, memories fade. In Steve Page's case, at this point, I'm not sure it's worth it to move forward. I go back and forth on this, especially if the physical evidence has been preserved. There has been no comment as to that evidence, but it seems to me if they were able to determine back in 1991 that the semen was from a man who had had a vasectomy, then they had evidence that could be tested for DNA. The first case where DNA successfully convicted someone was in 1987. I'm just guessing that Vidar did not have the resources at the time for testing, and to be fair, the widespread use of DNA in trials would not be for several more years. And even then, early juries struggled to understand or even believe it as evidence. But times have changed, and DNA is now considered standard evidence in all courts. But the Vidar police have never been able to charge Steve Page due to what they say is a lack of direct evidence and probable cause. So I think it's obvious that the physical evidence was lost. Why else would they not have tested it by now? Honestly, if they had it, wouldn't they have wanted to exonerate Steve Page once and for all and get the damned billboards taken down? Or wouldn't they have used it years ago to convict him, redeeming Vidar's reputation and stopping the negative press? It's been almost 27 years without even a whiff of another suspect or any movement in this case. In my heart, I want them to put Steve Page on trial. The family won a wrongful death suit 17 years ago, but clearly that has not brought any closure. Yes, the evidence against him is circumstantial, but it's still strong. That doesn't mean I think they would convict him. Like I said, memories fade, and her own daughter wants this all to just go away. And I'm sure the district attorney is looking at the budget. If you've waited this long, what are your chances of a win? Pretty low. And murder trials cost a lot of money. The overall crime rate in Orange County, Texas is 19% higher than the rest of the country. I'm sure with that statistic comes a hard choice. You try the cases you can win. You plead out the cases that you can't. Unfortunately, those that fall in the middle often go cold. I do agree with Jimmy Fulton that the police botched this case. They let years pass before they even got a search warrant for the Page home, and they failed to search the area around the car or house. They also failed to subpoena phone records that could have supported some of the circumstantial evidence. And it would also appear they have lost crucial physical evidence. Hell, they even failed to put film in the damn camera at the crime scene. And bottom line, they should have treated Steve Page as a suspect the minute he opened the door at Kathy's house. They did not. This sort of thing seems unheard of in today's world where we are weaned on shows like Law & Order and CSI. But most cases are only as good as their original investigation. It's not like any new evidence is going to magically appear now. The new Vidar police chief, Rod Carroll, said one of the first things he did when he took over was look at Kathy Page's file. He insists they still need evidence for probable cause. Quote, "Sometimes someone will grow a conscience and come forward." Well, if he's waiting for someone in Vidar, Texas to grow a conscience, there will never be justice. I think I would rather see Steve Page go to trial and risk him being found not guilty. He has gone free for this long, so it would not be much of a bitter pill to swallow at this point. It would be a waste of tax dollars, though, and I'm not sure the county cares enough to risk their budget. Kathy Page's murder has also been turned over to the Texas Rangers and is listed on their website as a cold case. Hopefully, they are actively investigating. But I am extremely doubtful that anyone wants to touch this case, because while the billboards may have kept Kathy's murder in the public eye, they are also a screaming advertisement for police failure and corruption, and no cop wants to be associated with that. Jimmy Fulton said that he has spent more than $200,000 on these billboards over the years. He is in his late 70s and fervently wishes for the case to be resolved before he dies. He hopes the movie Three Billboards will spark renewed interest in the case. I think it already has. But new interest is not new evidence, and I'm afraid there will never be a reckoning for Kathy Page. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. If you like the show, please tell a friend or rate and review it on iTunes. I know iTunes doesn't make this easy for you, but it is still the best way for others to find Southern Fried, so I really appreciate your help. I am also on Stitcher and many other apps like Auto Radio, Overcast, and Pocket Casts. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to patreon.com/Southern Fried True Crime. I have different rewards set for each level of donation. You can also support the show by visiting my shop at whatamaneuver.net. You can order t-shirts, tanks, hoodies, and even onesies for babies. They do great work with quality materials, and I'm really excited about this partnership. Again, that is whatamaneuver.net and search for Southern Fried True Crime. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Southern Fried True Crime if you would like to connect with me there. If you're interested in discussing the Page case, along with the movie Three Billboards, come check out my discussion group on Facebook. It is linked to the main Southern Fried page. I would love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.